This paid program may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to the Business of Government Hour, a conversation about management with a government executive who is changing the way government does business. The Business of Government Hour is produced by the IBM Center for the Business of Government, which was created in 1998 to encourage discussion and research into new approaches to improving government effectiveness. You can find out more about the center by visiting us on the web at businessofgovernment.org. And now, the Business of Government Hour.
Welcome to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Michael Keegan, your host and managing editor of the Business of Government magazine. Every day across the United States, the nation's health and human services agencies touch millions of lives. These agencies are serving record numbers because jobs are scarce and living expenses are high. In a time of sharply rising needs and limited budgets, these agencies recognize that they need to change the way they do business. The human services system is now on an unsustainable path. Its operations are too fragmented, too focused on process, and too inefficient to deliver on outcomes. Public human services must move in a new direction, down new pathways, if it is to meet increased demand for assistance at a time of tight budgets and heightened expectations. What are the critical challenges and significant trends facing health and human service agencies? How does the American Public Human Services Association's Pathways Initiative seek to transform this system? We will explore these questions and so much more with our very special guest, Tracy Waring, Executive Director of the American Public Human Services Association. Tracy, welcome to the show. It's great to have you.
Great to be here. Thank you very much for the invitation.
Also joining our conversation from IBM is Nicole Gartner. Nicole, welcome.
Thank you so much, Michael.
So, Tracy, before we delve into specific initiatives, perhaps you can provide us with a brief overview of the history, mission, and activities of the American Public Human Services Association. When was it created, and how has its mission evolved to date?
Yeah, we're a bipartisan nonprofit membership organization. We represent public sector human service agencies at the state and local level through their top-level executives and their senior leadership. And what that really means is that there are government agencies in states and in local jurisdictions that provide nutrition assistance programs, aging and disability services, child welfare, and other types of supports. And those agencies and their leadership come to us to support their work as a membership association. Our mission is to pursue excellence in human services by supporting our member agencies, informing and working with national policymakers in particular, and working with partners to drive integrated and efficient solutions in policy and practice. We were created actually in 1930, so have been around for a really long time. We had a name change around the time of welfare reform. We were the American Public Welfare Association, changed to American Public Human Services Association. We have 9 affiliate organizations whose members help administer specific programs like SNAP, which is a food stamp program, as well as things that really cross the enterprise of a public sector agency like information technology. So we have our IT solutions management group that brings together professionals who work within human service agencies and support their technology needs. And really, in all, what we do is help represent members before national policymakers on issues of human services. We issue policy recommendations. We bring our members together to have conferences and meetings to exchange best practices and information in the field. And we work to prepare guidance and tools that support our members in their ability to do their jobs in the states.
So it's such an interesting mission. Would you give us a sense of the scale of operation of your organization and possibly its affiliates? Maybe tell us a little bit about these members their size of their budgets, or give a sense of their scale of operation?
Sure. Well, our annual operating budget as an association is around $5 million. That's inclusive of our affiliate organization. So essentially, we operate as one nonprofit entity. So if you think about the tax code and a 501c3 designation, all of our affiliates and the association operate as one entity. We have about 30 full-time employees, most of whom work out of Washington, D.C. Our members themselves are those human service agencies from most of the states, as well as about 150 local county human service run agencies who deliver human services at that county level or at a city level. And so it's the top level, top leaders, rather, of those agencies who are active members in the association. We also have hundreds of individual members who are simply interested in the field or who work in the field and want to stay connected to what's happening at the national level.
So, Tracy, let's transition to your specific role as the executive director. Can you tell us more about your duties and responsibilities as the leader of APSHA?
So I work in coordination with a governing board of directors, which is made up of volunteers, many of whom are also leaders at the state level, and I'm responsible for really helping set our strategic direction as an as a membership organization, supporting our membership in exchange of information and knowledge, and making sure we operate smoothly as a membership association, which of course means having responsibility for overseeing our budget, ensuring that we have adequate revenue to carry out the work on behalf of our members. Probably most importantly, work in close coordination with our lead policy body, since a large part of what we do is try to work with national policymakers on issues impacting our field. And that body is made up of mostly cabinet-appointed from the governors across the states, the people who lead those human service agencies, and they help us basically take the direction of the organization. I mean, we don't really exist without our members. And so those leaders help us frame what are the policy positions that we're trying to advance on their behalf. And so I work very closely with those leaders to make sure that what we're doing is what they want us to be doing.
So regarding your duties and responsibilities, what are some of your top challenges that you face in your current position, and how have you sought to address those challenges?
Well, I think, you know, almost all of the challenges today could be described in the current landscape in which we're operating. There are a lot of opportunities in there as well, and I'll touch upon how we think about that. But the challenges really are that there is a current trajectory, largely because of the weak economy that we've had in this country for the last several years, that's put us on what many would say is an unsustainable path. And when you think about the fact that human services are largely supports for low-income populations or folks who may have lost their job or who need assistance to make sure that they've got food on the table for their children, when you have a difficult economic environment, that demand goes up, but the resources go down. So that landscape, and then you add to it what is a pretty highly polarized political landscape right now, a lot of conversation and debate about what's the appropriate role of government, that puts a very interesting mix in terms of how you advance national policy. And so if I boil down the challenges, it's how do you work within a very urgent need for change, because there really is this trajectory that is potentially unsustainable in terms of cost, and do that when you're facing a lot of debate about what's the appropriate, most effective way to do that with government support, and where does that role fit?
So given your experience as both as a lawyer, as a state executive, and in your federal time, what that makes an effective leader? What are some of the characteristics of an effective leader?
Well, I firmly believe in kind of the ever-changing environment that we all work in now, that effective leaders have to be adaptive leaders. And what does that mean? I think, we have to get ahead of change before it happens. So you really have to be anticipating and thinking about not just what's going to happen in the next 3 months, but what's going to happen in the next 3 to 5 years, and help your organization position itself in a way to take advantage of opportunities that are going to grow and enhance advance it as an organization. I think effective leaders have to resist the tendency to be turf-oriented and think about their organization in the broader enterprise, in which an ecosystem, if you will, in which they work. We can't be afraid of kind of bucking the sacred cows, those things, the policies and practices that have been in place for a long time. And many times leaders will come in and really want to change, but, you know, get all sorts of resistance to that. And then really being able to change mid-course, constantly evaluate how you're doing, what impact you're having, and know when you have your own shortcomings and biases. Probably my biggest learning is to really understand where I might, just because of the nature of how I approach things, might not see things, and surround myself with folks who view it differently to make sure that those biases don't get in the way of leadership.
What are the critical challenges and significant trends facing health and human service agencies? We will ask Tracy Waring, Executive Director of the American Public Human Services Association, when our conversation continues on the Business of Government Hour. What is fast government, and how can focusing on time and speed deliver real and lasting benefits? How are changing work habits and technology decreasing the federal government's real estate footprint? And how are VA and HUD working to end chronic homelessness among veterans? Pick up the latest edition of the Business of Government magazine and find out. We go beyond the buzz to introduce and connect our readers to actual public sector executives who are changing the way government does business. All of this and more in the latest edition of the Business of Government magazine. Order your free copy at businessofgovernment.org. Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Michael Keegan, your host, and our guest today is Tracy Waring, Executive Director of the American Public Human Services Association. Also joining our conversation from IBM is Nicole Gartner. So, Tracy, you mentioned in the previous segment that the fiscal realities of today, now more than ever, leaders have to act with strategic intent. And what I mean by that is focus on the goals and vision and objectives necessary to achieve an agency or an organization's mission. Would you tell us about your internal vision for your organization going forward and briefly highlight some of the key strategic priorities?
Well, I couldn't agree more with the premise of your question, that to provide value in these times, a membership association like APHSA has to support the field to a desired future state, if you will, of where you want the field to be, as well as practical steps for how to get there. And so we have launched in the last year our members' policy and practice agenda, and I'll explain a little bit more about why it's important to think about it as policy and practice, called Pathways, the Opportunities Ahead for Human Services. And I'm certainly happy to share more details about what the agenda entails, but at its heart, to kind of get to the, you know, the heart of your question about strategic priorities, it's really about a commitment to work within our field and beyond to drive real positive change and to focus on how to get to greater impact at less cost and achieve better sustainable results for the people that are served through the system. It's about anticipating really what's coming down the pike and positioning ourselves to take advantage of those opportunities. Our Pathways effort is really focused on identifying solutions that transcend those differences that are out there a lot right now in kind of the political environment and keep us focused on achieving the outcomes that we want to see for people who live in our communities. And I think one piece about our strategic work and our priorities is we've really tried to position this agenda, if you will, as not just a set of recommendations that are on a document that we go hand around to folks, but really as a larger effort and campaign that's something our members can use in their own states, that involves a greater network of the community of partners that we work with, and really can help us start to think about what the next generation of health and human services looks like in this country.
So the vision that was formed by sort of the conditions that you've spelled out and the realities of today. To that end, can you outline the critical challenges and the significant trends facing the affiliates that you mentioned, as well as public human service delivery in general?
Well, I think, you know, one piece just to hone in a little bit more is when we talk about that trajectory of cost and demand and how it's impacted human services, I think it's not surprising that, you know, people need help when an economy isn't doing so well, right? So people are out of a job or may need assistance in making sure that their family has health care or, you know, adequate nutrition. And so, but at the same time, there's those intense fiscal and political pressures that are forcing a system to try to meet that demand, but with fewer resources to do it. So that in and of itself is a challenge you have to try to work through. But it's coupled by, I think, some misperceptions, if you will, about what the system currently does and how it supports folks. And so part of what our work has to be is how do we cut through the noise, if you will, and really talk about what it is the system is intended to do. It's not intended to create dependency on government. It's really about creating avenues and using really early interventions and prevention efforts to ensure that we don't have people fall into what we often refer to as the deeper ends and the more costly ends of the government system, but support them early on and move them to a place that is, you know, their own self-sufficiency. But it requires us to really think through how we talk about our work, convey what it really looks like, do a much better job of showing our return on investment or our social return on investment, if you will. And I think those are some challenges for the field that we really need to do a better job of addressing.
And Tracy, you mentioned that the system that we're talking about is unsustainable. Some, as I was prepping for this, some say it's too fragmented, too process-oriented, and arguably too inefficient to deliver on the outcome sought. And you had mentioned that Pathways is an initiative that sort of responds to this issue. I'd like to talk a little bit more about that policy and practice aspect of Pathways. Can you tell us a little bit more about the overarching goals?
Absolutely. Well, let me start by elaborating a little bit more on what the desired future state is, right? Because I think that brings some context about what then Pathways actually calls for. But the desired future state really of human services from our members' perspective is that it really be person and family centered, so that it's responsive to the individual that's coming to the door, not cookie cutter in its approach, and really more effective because it's really thinking about what the individual needs are. That it's integrated. And what I mean by that is that we have a lot of different program silos right now, just due to the nature of how we've set up our system in this country through different funding silos and different programs. And they really need to speak and communicate with each other much more than they do now. We think the desired future state has to be modern, right? Cost effective, based on what are modern business models. That can be a challenge for organizations that have worked in certain kinds of environments that become institutionalized and hard to move through and beyond what their kind of status quo has been. And then I think it's really important that the desired future state, in addition to really focusing on those long-term outcomes, is accountable. And I think that I hear that probably more from my members than anything else, is that they want to see a system that they do believe in accountability. Sometimes I think that there's this notion that they don't, but they really want to see wise use of dollars, effective use, and actually getting to real outcomes. So what our Pathways effort really calls for is a couple of or a few things that I think are worth highlighting. One is maybe a new, certainly a sustainable relationship among all levels of government. So what does it look like? We have a certain structure in this country around the federal, state, and local structure that is constantly evolving. We've got to have it be as effective as possible and as dynamic as possible. And so our Pathways effort really calls for making sure that it's a true partnership and that there's commonality in the way that we approach finding solutions across the federal, state, and local level. To that end, there's also this conversation about having to think about how we govern in a different way. In other words, in a more shared way. There are a number of other partners who work in private industry, who work in this field and provide an incredible amount of insight. There are nonprofit organizations who help deliver services. We have to maximize those relationships and think about things and what the words that often get used in our field are in a shared governance approach. So how do we think about our work, not in our individual agency silos, but that we're actually, if you will, governing together? And then I think there's a big call for thinking about new funding models. What are new ways that we can actually finance the system? There is certainly a push for thoughtful but aggressive adoption of innovations. I can't tell you how many times I hear about incredibly successful efforts happening in states, in local jurisdictions that are having very real impact on communities and driving positive outcomes. But we don't have a very efficient way in our government sectors to elevate and scale those innovations across the board. And so I think there's room at all levels of state, local, and federal to think about ways that we help make that happen in a more real and effective way.
So as a follow-up, how are you engaging the frontline service providers, your affiliates, in both informing the Pathways Initiative, as well as, more importantly, incorporating some of the lessons they have learned?
Well, I think for sure that as human services field develops what its actual positions are on policy, so if we're trying to advance a particular policy, it is incredibly important that we draw lessons from the ground level experimentation that's happening, right? Both successes and lessons learned, as you just mentioned. One of the ways in which we are doing this is something we call Raise the Local's Voice. It is an effort where we are collecting stories from local human service agencies and communities around innovations that really are about getting to those improved outcomes for the families and that come to the doors of the public sector agencies. And there are incredible lessons learned and good success stories to share, right? But probably one of the most beneficial things you get out of it is what didn't work and what did you have to adjust? And then other folks who go down that path can really learn from and take those experiences to their own work that they're trying to carry out in their community. So we're trying to share those examples. We've built a number of stories available on our website that really bring those examples to life, to really give some real life examples of what's actually occurring out there. And then I would also say we have a team that is part of our staff at the association that helps our members through something we call organizational effectiveness. And it's really an approach to organizational improvement. We've specifically spent time applying that to the human services public sector field. And we've now done over 70 projects in 30 different states at state level and at local level. And those experiences were a really rich part of ensuring that what we were advocating through our membership in terms of policy was rooted in what actual experiences were actually occurring on the ground. And, you know, I mentioned that we have 9 affiliate organizations, really all under our umbrella. And while those happen to usually be top-level administrators of those programs, I will tell you that they bring a lot of reality to our conversations about, that sounds like a really nice policy, but here's what's going to happen when you try to implement it. And so they've really helped inform our work as well.
So that's a great description of the connectedness between the policy and the practice. Can you summarize for us a little bit holistically what some of the characteristics of a 21st century health and human services system could be? And does that rest on shaping a whole new business model for service delivery?
Well, I'll tell you, we've done some pretty extensive thinking in this area with a lot of input from some of our partners. And the answer in a comprehensive way would take more time than we have here. But it really, two things. One, I do think it really makes us think about what is an appropriate 21st century business model for that next generation of health and human services. And it goes to some of the pieces that are, you know, part of that desired future state. Are we person and family centered? Are we integrated? Are we modern? Are we focused on outcomes? And how do we sustain and incentivize that kind of system? So we have established a new business model with some criteria that we think has to be in place. We can do all the greatest thinking in the world on policy, but if we haven't readied the system at the state or local level to be able to move that forward, we won't get very far. So when I go back to that why it's a policy and practice agenda, partly that's because you really then have to think about how you would operationalize in a system policy changes. So we have a number of things that we've created as guidance and as tools through some work that we're doing, especially around integrating health and human services, that talk about what that business model should look like.
So you mentioned the IT side of it. So let's talk a little bit about the role of IT that could play in your efforts to successfully transform this whole environment. And how can technology and the benefits of it have an impact on the interoperability that you're trying to do in terms of breaking down those silos? And, what are some of the challenges there vertically and horizontally to keeping that from happening?
Well, technology is certainly a major enabler of getting to that desired future state of integrated and interoperable systems at the human services level and with health. And I'll talk a little bit more about what I mean by that. Without a doubt, we have so many technology advances in this country that can eliminate duplicative administrative steps, help us save money by streamlining our business practices, that historically took a whole lot of paperwork, probably frustrated customers to no end with, oh, I know I already submitted that piece of paperwork, and resulted really in long processing timelines and delay in getting services to folks. We have data sharing and analytics that can help us better understand what it is that works and what doesn't. This whole growing field of predictive analytics, which is being used immensely in the private world, is finding its way into the public sector and into human services as well, about how do we understand trends and impacts and make sure that our programs are as effective as possible and cut wasteful spending, cut doing things that don't work. And then I think the mobile technology is really just completely changing the way we think about service delivery. I often say to folks, if you asked me 5 years ago, when I was still in the state of Arizona, about putting our applications on mobile smartphones, I'm not sure we would have even used the term smartphone, but on mobile phones, I'm sure my answer would have been, most of the populations we serve don't have cell phones. Well, that is changing. Pew Commission report came out earlier, or I guess last year now, that talked about the fastest growing population acquiring cell phones and smartphones is the low income population. We have to be thinking about that in terms of ease of use, what it might mean for government efficiency if people are able to process their information through a mobile application, what that could mean for people in terms of getting employment. So if someone is out of a job, the ease of access of getting to them because they can have a cell phone and handle things in a mobile way while they're also taking care of their kids or whatever it is they need to be doing, we really have to, I think, take advantage of that as a field. We have a couple of things that are happening in the association that I think are worth mentioning. First of all, we have our IT Solutions Management affiliate that brings and has brought for many, many years leaders that support the technology advancements in the public sector agencies together to share best practices and to really think about the way that we can have technology be enabler for the change that we all desire.
So another trend that I need to speak about is social media and the expectation that those who use it, that they can get stuff from the social media platform. They can get information. And this is growing exponentially. And you mentioned smartphones and the whole. So it's sort of a twofold question. How are the affiliates or the agencies using or leveraging social media to meet mission? And then the next part of that is, how are you folks using it?
So I start with the premise on social media that the human services, the public sector, we're behind in the use of social media. It's happening, and I don't want to minimize that. There's a great deal of potential and a great deal of discussion, especially among the agencies, about how to leverage what they know is now the mainstream way of communicating, right? There are some incredibly innovative ideas that are being put into play. There's a something called Casebook, which is being implemented in Indiana, that's based on a platform similar to Facebook, that's about supporting child welfare programs. And both the staff that do that work, as well as the families that become involved in the child welfare system. There are online communities of practice popping up all over the place that are connecting leaders at all different levels of government to their peers in other jurisdictions, and not even just government, public, private communities of practice as well. And, you know, that kind of, whether you use LinkedIn or any other social media platform, that kind of community where you can instantaneously share information is really helping make sure that some of those isolated innovations are no longer isolated, right? They're getting shared and communicated. But there's a whole bunch more that we need to do. Our organization as an association hasn't leveraged the social media component in the way I think we need to. We have a community of practice that we've built in partnership with Harvard most recently that we're going to be trying to launch in a bigger way this year. But there's just so much to be done, and we know we're behind, and we're going to be looking to private industry to really help us figure out how to leverage it.
So, Tracy, your Pathways Initiative identifies the importance of citizen engagement. I thought when I was thinking about this, it'd be a nice segue from social media to talk about this, but what does this mean in practice, this concept of citizen engagement, and how can it, in practice, lower costs and improve outcomes?
Well, I think fundamentally, when we talk about citizen engagement and involvement of the community, I think when we talk about getting to that next generation of health and human services or transforming the way we do our work, government's not going to do it alone. It has to be done with full engagement of community. And in fact, I would say a large part of what happens in communities already, especially communities that have really come together and have strong community engagement, is they recognize the power of what nonprofit organizations, what faith organizations, what individuals who are interested in public service can bring, so that government actually is able to maybe provide the more intensive services for folks who might have long-term needs. So, you know, you think about costs, for example, and supports that are necessary for folks with significant developmental disabilities. And so government resources can go there because the community really has wrapped around some of the other pieces.
How are human service agencies changing the way they do business? We will ask Tracy Waring, Executive Director of the American Public Human Services Association, when our conversation continues on the Business of Government Hour. What is fast government, and how can focusing on time and speed deliver real and lasting benefits? How can serendipitous collision change the way agencies do business? How are changing work habits and technology decreasing the federal government's footprint? Get your latest edition of the Business of Government magazine and find out. We go beyond the buzz to introduce and connect our readers to actual public sector executives who are changing the way government does business. All of this and more in the latest edition of the Business of Government magazine. Get your free copy at businessofgovernment.org. Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Michael Keegan, your host, and our guest today is Tracy Waring, Executive Director of the American Public Human Services Association. Also joining our conversation from IBM is Nicole Gartner. Tracy, states have developed extensive internal quality improvement processes that monitor their progress towards outcomes, and they use evidence-based practices for sound and reliable results. Would you tell us more about your efforts to build and, where possible, foster evidence-informed or evidence-based practices?
Sure. Well, I think there's a great deal of conversation in the human services community about how important it is to be able to track whether a service or an intervention is having a positive impact. Is the performance that we want really happening? And, you know, are the investments that we're making in it really worth what we're putting towards it. So there's a lot of conversation about evidence-based practices. What I would say is that we've actually started to change that frame to evidence-informed practices. And what I mean by that is that evidence-based tends to require an incredible amount of rigor. It's often tied to significant resources, long-term studies, academic folks who come to the table and help you really study your program. And I don't want to minimize the value. It's intensely helpful, and there are a number of evidence-based programs, particularly in the child welfare area, that have really focused on community-based prevention that are very well-known. Healthy Families is one you might hear, home visitation, nurse program type of work where you go in and work very early with a family, and then you've seen dramatic reductions in child abuse. So there are great evidence-based programs out there. But there's a whole bunch that are more framed around this evidence-informed, especially as we think about what technology we have now. So, you know, we have a lot of data in our systems. We have these new tools that exist that I don't pretend to understand in great detail that allow us to predict behaviors, understand much more about what works and what doesn't, and don't necessarily cost what it costs to do a long-term study that gets something labeled as evidence-based. So both are really important to the field. Again, if we're going to really maximize what investments and dollars we spend, we want to be able to show that they work. We just need to be careful, I think, that we don't require evidence-based, intensely expensive reviews that aren't really palpable in a constrained fiscal environment.
So, Tracy, you've mentioned analytics a couple of times, and we all know how inundated we are with information and data. So let's explore a little bit more about how analytics is being used in the space of human services. What are your affiliates doing, and how are they using analytics more effectively to go beyond just the transformation of data but into this predictive thing and other things that you could talk about? And can you elaborate on how organizations are using analytics to change service delivery and focus on outcomes?
Well, I think the question about analytics and how much data and big data we have out there is something that's on our members' minds all the time. And so leaders of a number of public sector agencies are becoming much more robust about how they think about their data. They're building it into their business model, if you will, a much more robust use and conversation, and in many cases, very high expectations about if we're not delivering, next time we meet next month, what are you going to do to show me how we're changing this? And so that, I think, is a very positive trend. Another trend that's out there is working very closely with universities and academia around what they can do to help us understand data. So there is a Center for State Foster Care and Adoption Data that's with Chapin Hall as one example that we are actually a part of. And states provide information from their foster care system to this data center. The data center helps them sort through it, helps us look at national trends, but also helps the states individually understand the information, sort through it, and make changes in the way they do their work based on that information. And those are, I think, really exciting innovations.
So, Tracy, APHSA's vision for a transformed human service system includes a reexamination of the current financing structure. Some observers believe that funding provided through the traditional state, federal, and local appropriations process will remain stagnant, if not continue to shrink. To that end, would you elaborate on the framework for alternative human service financing?
Well, I think first it's helpful to understand what the current system is. It's pretty fragmented and siloed in the way that it gets delivered, and typically has rules. So if some funding comes from certain federal agencies that don't necessarily have the same rules. We have congressional committees that vary. They're not all these programs aren't in just one congressional committee. You can't just go to Congress in one committee and say, fix it all. So if you understand that as the context, when we talk about an alternative system, what we're really talking about is the ability to have the best use of those resources. So you'll hear people talk about social impact financing, social impact bonds. The idea really is that you get an outside investor who comes in and says, okay, I'll put up the money and agree to help pay for services, with the intent being that we're going to, in the next, let's set a time frame, 5 years, achieve these outcomes. So we're going to have all these better outcomes in whatever program we're delivering. And once that outcome is achieved, then government comes in and pays the investor back for what they've provided. And then, of course, they get some kind of incentive or a bonus on top of that.
So given all of this, and we've got this thing on the horizon there called the Affordable Care Act, and given the perspectives you've elaborated on, can you talk to us a little bit about some of the impacts of ACA and the health information exchanges and the landscape and how all this is changing human and health services delivery in the U.S., and then also maybe some of the challenges that it brings in terms of the benefits that could be derived?
The changes that are happening through the Affordable Care Act or other healthcare reforms, you know, they're extensive, they're far-reaching, they're huge challenges for states in terms of cost and what it costs, Medicaid and otherwise. There's a really ambitious schedule in terms of the new healthcare exchanges that are being stood up. And so I think all of those things are understood from the perspective of human service leaders. And I'll tell you, some leaders in states govern both the health and the human services, and some states it's separate. So where we've really spent our time and tried to focus our field is, where is the potential in this time of great change and potential new, for example, technology systems that have to be stood up because you're creating these new healthcare exchanges? Where's the way to connect that to the human service programs? And there are some attractive funding mechanisms that I mentioned around some flexibility that the federal government has provided, some an enhanced match where a significant amount of dollars are flowing to states to help them build their technology systems on the healthcare side. And there's some exceptions that they've made to rules that would historically have said you have to cost allocate across all the programs, including on the human services side, if you want to enhance the technology on the human services side. And there's some exceptions right now that are allowing states to really think about integrating their systems and using this opportunity, if they're going to build new systems, to use the best technology and connect it on the human services side. So it's both a challenge in that there are incredible time pressures and cost pressures facing states, but there also are real opportunities. And our focus really has been on both pushing national policymakers to make sure that they see those opportunities and give states the ability to leverage them, and then to make sure that states know about what potential they could do to really connect the systems together in a way that would really completely transform the way we think about and connect the health and the human service delivery system.
Tracy, I'd like to understand more about the National Work Group on Integration. Could you tell us a little bit about its mission? How is it developing guidance tools, disseminating best practices, and possibly recommending changes to laws and regulations?
So the National Work Group on Integration really was developed about probably a little less than 18 months ago to really think about the integration on of the healthcare side to the human services side. It's got a very diverse membership. We've got 14 states that are active participants, four counties, Montgomery County, New York City, San Diego, and Sacramento are all part of this as well. So it's not just a state involved. It's got seven businesses, which I think is an interesting and been very helpful mix for us. So big companies that work in the health and human services field, federal agencies at the table with these other folks. So we're not necessarily just going to the federal government after everybody's met and said, here's what we want to do. They're at the table with us. Very senior level folks from the Administration of Children and Families and CMS, as well as the Food and Nutrition Program through USDA, all participating in this work group. The group itself has focused on providing guidance to states on how would you think about a governance structure of an integrated health and human service delivery system? What are the technology pieces that you have to be thinking about? And what's that new business model that we talked about? We've done a lot of work providing what I would say are kind of timely FAQs, frequently asked questions for our members when new guidance comes out. Sometimes the guidance that comes out from the federal government is quite extensive. And we try to sort through that and get the most meaningful, help get the most meaningful information out. We had a very interesting set of work last year where we did a 7-part webinar series where we went out and highlighted what states that are participating in the National Work Group on Integration are doing. And so they were able to share in more detail the way that they're approaching the integration of their health and human services. And we're very excited about the work that's going forward this year. There'll be some additional guidance, particularly around financing and how we might think about doing that. And we've developed something called a maturity model that's really helped to design states figure out where they fall in a continuum of integration, right? How much work do they, where are they at? What do they need to do to really get to that new business model? And there's some pretty exciting work that's happening. I could mention every single one of the states that's involved is doing some pretty cool things. But if listeners are really interested in checking one out, San Diego County has a multi-year initiative called Live Well San Diego that is really about linking their systems and reengineering the way that they do their business across their health and human services spectrum and has some great things that folks might be interested in seeing.
What does the future hold for human service delivery in the U.S.? We will ask Tracy Waring, Executive Director of the American Public Human Services Association, when our conversation continues on the Business of Government Hour. What is fast government and how can focusing on time and speed deliver real and lasting benefits? How are VA and HUD working to end chronic homelessness among veterans? What is national health security and how do we get there as a country? Pick up the latest edition of the Business of Government magazine and find out. We bring you insights and interviews from government executives who are changing the way government does business. All of this and more in the latest edition of the Business of Government magazine. Download or order your free copy at businessofgovernment.org. Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Michael Keegan, your host, and our guest today is Tracy Waring, Executive Director of the American Public Human Services Association. Also joining our conversation from IBM is Nicole Gartner. So, Tracy, in an era of fiscal constraint, I'd like your perspective on how human service organizations can continue to keep their employees focused and motivated when faced with some painful, maybe dramatic changes.
Well, I think, you know, there's a lot to be said about the role that leaders play in supporting the workforce through challenging times. And quite frankly, in many ways, there's always been challenging times for this field because of some perceptions about what the work is. And there are a lot of incredibly dedicated people who spend their lives really trying to support their communities, the people that live in their communities, believe very much in their work. And so I know that this is near and dear to a lot of leaders that I work with, people who are part of our organization or have worked in the organization. And there's something about, you know, I mentioned that the concept around being an adaptive leader. There is some really interesting work that really was pioneered by Professor Ron Heifetz at Harvard Kennedy School around adaptive leadership. And we've spent a lot of time thinking about what does that mean for our field and what can that mean for supporting the workforce. It's, I think, incumbent upon leaders who do this work. And I mean leaders at all level. I don't mean leaders just at the top, but people who help run programs, you know, middle level managers, you know, first line supervisors, to think about and learn about how to be an adaptive leader and be able to help people through the challenges we face and keep them focused on what it is that, you know, makes our work so interesting and can have an impact. The reason people come into social services in the first place is because they tend to be people, and they really want to support others. And so keeping focused on that, working to provide the kinds of simple supports that the workforce needs, technology being one of them, that's been a challenge for many. You think about our incoming workforce, the younger generation. It can be quite shocking for someone who, you know, goes through college, decides they want to spend time in the public sector, and is fairly used to some very basic technology things for us in terms of, and then they come in and they have an old mainframe, you know, a computer, or they don't have the mobile applications. And so I think leaders really have to be thinking about, are they getting those tools to their workforce?
So more on the workforce. So the 21st century workforce is characterized as being flat, agile, nonlinear, collaborative, flexible, and as you mentioned, mobile. So to that end, telework and the virtual workplace are changing the way government does its business and interacts with citizens. To what degree are these business operations changes affecting your affiliates? And is APSHA assisting state and local agencies with best practices and approaches in this area?
Well, I think this is an interesting question, because when you talk about telework in the virtual workplace, it's actually not so new to the public sector human services field. Was clearly new 10 years ago, probably 5 years ago, kind of in the stage of a lot of folks implementing. But a lot of members that are part of our organization have these in place in a pretty robust way now. And sometimes, you know, in some situations have completely closed down offices and done things that actually save taxpayer money, right, because they're delivering things in a different environment. The whole notion that's kind of related to telework of hoteling, where you basically have a place where people can come and have a desk, but they don't have their own office, right, is another thing that I think the field is really looking at. But when I say all that, I think we still haven't necessarily done enough work to ensure that we've thought through, okay, now if we don't have a workforce that necessarily comes to an office every day, what does that mean for supervision? What does that mean for connecting and communicating with the folks that are served? There's a lot of delivery that comes through the human services that really only requires a transaction. And that can be done through a lot of technology and doesn't require in-person meetings. But there are people who need supports that need that more personal interaction. And so how do you make sure that happens, and what's the balance? And so I think those are things that we have to really still kind of build into that business model. So this is part of the work that we're doing as we get a little bit, we've set some kind of broad principles of what a 21st century business model looks like. Now we're going to be talking about what's the practical application and what does that mean for our members. Those are some of the things that'll be forthcoming. And there's, you know, that all, there's also that piece about how do we not, oh, I guess I said this a little bit, but really how do we not lose that personal touch, mm-hmm. Which can be so important. And you might miss a lot if you're not sitting across from someone and really understanding body language and that sort of thing in terms of what they might need. So those are, you know, those are challenges. But I think if we can sort through what really requires that light kind of transactional touch and what requires the in-person piece, we can continue to benefit from the notions of telework and virtual workplace.
I'd like to transition to the future. You've alluded to it throughout our conversation of a re-envisioned 21st century system. But could you tell us what are some of the key issues that will affect some of your affiliates over the next couple of years?
Well, I think there's the reality that there's likely to be a continued decline in resources. I think we haven't really begun to experience what might happen on the federal funding side. There is certainly going to be some major conversations already occurring and likely to start to have real impact around what have historically been known as the entitlement programs and how those might be reshaped. Now, there's a huge opportunity there as well, but how that actually plays out will be something that we'll have to really, you know, be thoughtful about and ready for. I think the continued advancements in technology are things that we have to be better able to anticipate as a field. We're still playing catch up, as I've noted in a couple different places around technology. We've got to position ourselves in a better place to really leverage what we don't even know is going to come down, you know, the pike in the next couple of years, and how we might use that to be effective and efficient in delivery of services. And then I think there's the whole notion around what's happening with healthcare, the pressures, the cost pressures of Medicaid and Medicare and the strain that puts on the states. Again, not quite sure how that all play out, but certainly things that we have to be anticipating and looking to address.
That's a wonderful perspective on the landscape in which you operate in. What about your organization?